Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint at WDEV Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, and it's another big show today. Gosh, we're going to have fun because guess who we've got in the studio? For hour one, an entire hour, we are talking to the one, the only, Rusty DeWeese, the logger. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on the Vermont Viewpoint. The first time I was on this radio station was in 1975. I was 15. I'm sitting in the same chair.
Okay. I'm going to try to not laugh the entire show. So before we get to Rusty, let's do some housekeeping. We will also talk to our people in Washington, D.C. about the upcoming elections. And then we're going to talk to Allison Novak, the reporter from 7 Days, about her recent article about the Orange County State Senate race between the incumbent Mark McDonald he lives in Williamstown, and the challenger, Republican John Klar, who's made a bit of a splash. And Democrats would call him an election denier. I think he would call himself a uniter. But we'd like to get it deep into that article with Allison Novak at 7 Days. The article is in this week's edition. We've got it here. We've got newspapers. We've got the Times Argus. We've got books. We've got the computer open. So we are open to the world. And stick around for the last segment, last 20 minutes or so, as we look forward to the upcoming elections, because your host might make some predictions.
You? Yeah, all right.
About what he thinks is going to happen. As always, we welcome your questions. You can reach us at 244-1777 or by email, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And remember that all our shows become podcasts so that you can find them online at wdevradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We welcome your questions. But first, our guest in studio right now is acclaimed actor, producer, musician, comedian, Stowe by birth, Elmore by, here we go.
Philly by birth.
Philly by birth.
7 years old, Stowe. Parents moved up.
Stowe, when he was seven, now a resident of beautiful downtown Elmore. He with one of the coolest Instagram feeds on earth.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, at least for me. Is Rusty DeWeese. So good to have you here.
Thanks. Working on OnlyFans. That's my next thing, you know, OnlyFans.
What does that mean? What do you mean, OnlyFans?
OnlyFans is a social media thing where you subscribe to my thing.
Oh.
A lot of times the OnlyFans, I think they're, you know, it's taking strip clubs down and things like, you know what I mean? Because you can go on there and see people doing stuff that you want to see doing stuff with a certain amount of clothes on or whatever. And you don't have to. That person now does not have to have someone handling them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it can be a better way to be in that business.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that, but that is what OnlyFans is. Yeah. Obviously, I'm not doing that. OnlyFans.
You know, there's a I have a nephew who's a comedian in New York City, and he's got his start on our producer Danny's going to identify with this. He got a start on Barstool Sports, which is a raunchy frat bro, really successful comedy channel. I think it's terrible, but mm-hmm. Kid's got 150,000 followers online, mm-hmm. and he got fired for going too far, which is always a line for people in your line of work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he goes out with those 150,000 Instagram followers, and he does stand up all over New England.
All over New England?
Yeah.
It's funny, 150,000 followers or somebody, 150,000 humans following you is now a big number because there are so many things for people to follow. So the soup gets watered down. Jimmy Fallon, what are there, 2 million people watching him? And that's a hit.
Yeah.
Carson, there were 21 million people a night, 39 million people a night. You know, so 150,000 is a lot to get. But if you get that, it's a dent.
They're dedicated followers. That's the thing.
Right, right. They're finding you. So it's it. Yeah, you don't have to score big to be scoring. But it's tough to score at all because there's so many players in anything.
That's right. Okay. Let's do some bio.
Bio it up.
So Rusty Deweese is the logger. I've been to the show at the theater in Stowe.
Oh, great.
What, 5 years ago? Took my whole family.
Oh, thanks.
Full disclosure, got a lot of conflict of interest here. I was a producer,
right,
in air quotes,
yeah,
on a movie, one of Jay Craven's movies in Chelsea when we lived in Chelsea in Orange County long time ago, on the movie A Stranger in the Kingdom, the famous story about the black minister who came to Vermont, came up to the kingdom, true story, and Jay had wrote a movie about it. And Rusty played kind of a dangerous bad guy in that movie in Chelsea. I remember you in the garage.
That was taken from the Irisburg incident,
yep.
Howard Frank Mosier novel.
Yep.
And Ernie Hudson, the black Ghostbuster, was in that. Yep. Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen.
A lot of great old Broadway stompers. But, yeah, the first scene that I shot with the guy that's my best friend in there, I was Harlan Kittredge. David Lansbury played the lawyer, the young lawyer, Charlie Kittredge.
Yeah.
And we just meet. And this poor – he was the lead character in the movie. This poor guy, David Lansbury, Angela Lansbury's nephew.
That's right.
Has to just go – this is one of his biggest scenes of the movie where he's conflicted. And he has to go to his best friend, who was me, and say, I know you're in on this. And that's acting. The first day we meet, he has to bring it. And I had to bring it too. And it was that garage. And that was a great movie, man. And I remember that. He punches me and my head hits the hood of the old Chevy. And I got to make out with a girl in that scene. And then Ernie Hudson comes up in a different scene. And so that was, yeah. Well, so we go way back.
Yeah.
Fun movie.
Fun movie. Fun movie. So, okay, as a young adult, you were in New York. You've been at the Vermont Repertory Theater. You trained at the George Loris Actor Studio and the Lee Strasberg Institute, which I didn't know. Scores of roles off-Broadway, television, film, national commercials, but you missed Vermont and you moved back to Vermont. You continued your acting career, developed the logger character in what date?
I started tinkering with that in like 96. Driving back and forth from Vermont to Manhattan almost every weekend, the last 5 years of my 11 that I lived in Manhattan and worked in Manhattan, I started to write those things driving back and forth.
Okay, so we got a lot of New York listeners. And a lot of Vermonters who know New York. So tell us about the New York experience. Where did you live? Because we spent 2 years in Brooklyn and had the time of our lives pre-COVID. I had an elderly father in Manhattan. We wanted to be closer to him and spend some time with him. What were those years like? Is this the 90s in Manhattan?
Literally. I moved there on New Year's Eve 1990. On New Year's Eve Day. Anyway, 29 years old I was, going from pumping gas at Shelburne Road, South Burlington, for Renee Bourne, to moving to New York to try to be an actor. And then I wasn't a guy that wanted to just be a waiter or something.
Yeah.
I wanted a real job. So I got a job being an assistant to a guy named William Doyle. And he owned William Doyle Galleries, an auction house in the Upper East Side. I go from pumping gas to going up and down Fifth Avenue looking for antiques with this guy, and also in the Hamptons. And he and his wife and his three daughters, I worked for them also, not just for the gallery. So I was this kid from Stowe, growing up in Stowe, and all of a sudden I'm in the art world in New York City literally overnight.
So here's a lesson for young people. How did you do that? How'd you find this guy? How'd you get the job?
Well, if you want to go, I'll go where I want to go with that great question, and I'll say, I got the, how I did it was, I said, what am I curious about? I went to a lot of movies when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too.
Right. And I would look at that screen and go, I'm curious. How does that guy get up there? How does that lady get up there? Because I've been at Hyde Park doing plays, and we do good plays, and people clap after. I like that. So I'm being dramatic about the answer. The love in the heart got me to New York City. And then when you get to New York City, the only thing you do, need to do every day when you get up, is live life. That's what's called, you're called to do.
Yeah.
So I got up every day and lived life. And I called my parents every Sunday. Mom said, your classmate Brian Smith works down there. And I saw Danny Shaw, Tiger Shaw's sister, you know,
yeah,
who was in my class, Danny Shaw.
Tiger Shaw, the famous Olympic skier.
Yeah, and former president of U.S. ski team.
He's that's not, right.
Anyway, and mom said, I saw Danny in the supermarket. And she said, Brian works at this auction house, and you could get a job holding up chairs during the auctions.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be an actor. Call Brian. Called Brian. Brian said, you don't have to hold chairs. My boss... there's a really interesting Guy Friday job available. My boss is a 47-year-old guy who started this auction house by himself on his own. And he needs a right-hand man. You'd be perfect for it. And I was. So I went and met Bill Doyle. He said, you start in 2 weeks. He was from Newton, Mass. Rustola. It's not yesterday. It's tomorrow. Make all your callbacks. Okay. We all had the same chance, Rustola. And we would go everywhere. And I would be in homes, whether it's an estate or somebody selling a couple things to send their godchild to Harvard. I was in the art business, the art world, overnight. Suits from Barney's paid for, 21 Club, takeout from the 21 Club paid for. I was kept except for my apartment. Incredible. Lightning struck at a bottle. I was there.
We want to take a call from Fred from Newberry. How are you, Fred? You're
Hi,
on
Fred.
With Rusty.
Hey, hey, you guys. Hey, look, I'm a real fan of the comedian stuff. So anyways, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
And I want to know if you can identify what type of joke I'm going to be talking about. I'll give you two examples. The first one is, last night I stayed up all night because I wanted to find out where the sun goes. And the next morning it dawned on me. And the next one is going to be, there were two hats on a hat rack, and one hat said to the other, you stay here, and I'll go on ahead.
So,
what kind of jokes are they?
I don't know really what you're talking about. I mean, they're lending themselves to riddles. And they're soft.
Yeah, okay, a riddle, yeah. You're close. But if you look it up with Google, they're called play on words jokes. Like I used to be a short order cook, but I couldn't find the time.
Right. So you know, you might be able to trace those back, Fred, to vaudeville. You know, hey, I used to be a short order cook, couldn't find the time. Bing, ba da boom, you know, and then the girl comes out, and then the monkey comes out juggling, so that's sort of vaudevillian. They're really quick. They're quick. You can get a lot in.
Yeah,
that's a lot of pops. That's the 4th of July fireworks end thing, what are they, a grand finale. Those are the boom, bang, bing, boom, boom. You know, and then there's stories. But anyway, yeah, it's cool, man. Keep it up.
Hey, Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Rusty, I want to go back to New York quickly before we talk about the loggers.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did you live in New York? You know, you were started off broke probably like everybody else.
A couple grand I had, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about New York back
when
in the day.
When I say that, you know, it's a couple grand. I'm not sitting here going, yeah, I only had $2,000. Kevin, I moved to New York, man.
Right, right.
And I was
going
– I mean, you know, I just drive back or, get, you know, take the train back to mom and dad or to my you know, mom and dad cooks me the stew and everything. I first lived on the West End Avenue between West End and Riverside on 76th in a studio. It was great. Yeah. Who lived right across from me on the corner, 333 West End Avenue? James Taylor. And I say that only because I'm this guy, 29-year-old guy, my first little studio in Manhattan. I had one chair like the one that's sitting behind you and had one of those old radios in there. and it was, and I would listen to the Knicks at night. And
Marv Albert?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Knicks?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So did I. I was in Jersey.
Right. And Walt Frazier was doing it with him then, Walt Clyde. But anyway, I'd be walking down the block, man, to take the crosstown from 79th to go over the east side to work, because that's where the auction house was. And there's James Taylor walking his little dogs. And my mind was like, whoa.
Yeah.
That's just growing up for me in Stowe, Vermont, and even up until 29 years old, you didn't get the big concerts in Vermont back then. Maybe the Champlain Fair was getting Roy Clark.
Right.
Or the Oak Ridge Boys.
Yeah.
You didn't have the big sports teams.
Yeah.
So when you grew up here and you saw James Taylor, that was all coming into you. You know,
yeah.
So that I started on West, and then I moved when I got the job at the gallery on the East Side. I moved over to the East Side, lived in four or five different places. Most of my time on Second between 78th and 72nd.
And when did you start?
78th and 77th, excuse me.
And when did you start moving into TV commercials? I think you acted on Law and Order.
A couple times.
When did that happen?
Yes, specifically Bill Doyle, who was William Doyle Gallery. I was his right-hand man. I got that job for 6 years. It was the most fascinating thing that anyone could fall into.
Yeah.
And I put the acting – I didn't literally put the acting aside, but I didn't put myself into the acting. I'm not a goal guy. So if I was 29 and moved to New York City with a goal of being an actor and getting an Emmy, I may not have allowed myself to take that full-time job with Doyle. If I had that goal, the goal was not, I didn't have a goal. I was curious about the acting. This other thing falls into my lap. Turns out to be one of the best things that could ever happen in anyone's life. I'm mentoring about business, life, art under this guy who's a savant. If I would have said, no, I'm going to be a waiter, which is fine too. So he died. 6 years into my job with Doyle, he died. Kathy, his wife, took over. It's now Doyle, New York. And she said, we'll teach you to be an American expert at Belle Epoque. I said, no, I know New York now. I think I want to kick in the acting. And I had been in Where the Rivers Flow North.
Yep.
And that was back in the day when independent movies were a new thing, with Jay Craven's movie. The New York Times came up and did an article about this Vermont guy doing independent movies.
He was on the cover of Esquire magazine.
Yeah.
Jay was.
It was big time back then.
Rip Torn was in that movie. Who else?
Treat Williams, Michael J. Fox.
And Treat Williams lives in Vermont. He's also
Manchester or something.
Yeah, he's got a great Instagram feed too.
So I'm fighting Rip Torn. A lot of people listening will know who he is, a big time actor. And a picture of me fighting Rip Torn got in the New York Times around the time Bill Doyle died. So I took that picture, had it mimeographed 100 times, and sent 100 envelopes out to 100 agents, got response from 10 of them. I got my New York agent I would come home in the summers and do summer stock when I was living, working landscaping for a soap opera actor who said to me, when you get back to New York, give me a call. I'll hook you up with my agent. I got my New York City agent by landscaping in Stowe, Vermont. That's how I got the agent.
Right.
All right. So I tell the young folks or the old folks, what did I do when I got back to New York that fall? I gave Benjamin Hendrickson a call, who had gone to Juilliard. John Houseman was his mentor. He was an Elephant Man on Broadway. He was a contract player on As the World Turns. I called Benjamin. Didn't know him at that point, but then I knew him. Became friends. And he said, hey, here, call Sue King at J. Michael Bloom, the hottest commercial agent of the time. Sue King sent me out in 2 weeks. I got a Citroen ad. 2 weeks I was flying to Cape Breton in Toronto in a Citroen ad. I had no idea I was saleable. That's what Benjamin told me. He said, Mark tells me you're trying to be an actor. He said, you can make a lot of money in commercials. I said, well, what's that mean?
Yeah.
Now, I'm a 35 at this time. You're very saleable. You can be the country boy, the bad guy, the truck driver, the cop, and you ain't got to say a word.
Right.
Just by what you look. A week later after that first commercial, I'm flying to L.A. first class because Screen Actors Guild, I got my SAG card by being in Ethan Frome that was shot in Peacham.
Oh, no kidding.
Taft Hartley'd me in.
Yeah.
It's a little rule that you can get us. Otherwise, it's really hard to get. And I'm flying to L.A. to do a Kellogg's Corn Flakes commercial. I was the only guy in it. I play a Maine lobsterman. And I get out. I take my limo. The guy's holding my name.
Yeah.
This is huge.
Yeah.
This is for a bit. And I'd always watch Robert De Niro in the movies when he did real good movies. I get out at the Shutters, which is on the Santa Monica, Santa Monica Pier. John Fusco, my good buddy for 30 years, said, boy, that's a nice place you're staying. And I open the door to the town car. I step onto the lobby entryway. And who am I standing in front of? Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman. And I'm like, I'm a 35-year-old guy. I don't know crap about acting. And I'm staying in the same place that Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman are staying. And I got in that lobby and took pictures of it with my Kodak and called my parents and said, you wouldn't believe this. Because I made the call. Because I was curious. I moved to New York City. I was never going to starve or die. It wasn't a risk.
Right.
It was a choice. I don't know a thing. And I'm working actor.
Okay. Now we're going to switch from New York. After the break, we're going to switch from Rusty Dewey's New York to You Get the Pang to Come Home or something.
Right.
And now we're going to spend some time on the Logger because we got to get to the upcoming dates of shows so the people can know where to show up and when.
All right,
you're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. It's Kevin Ellis, your host, and we've got the one and only Rusty Dewey in studio. We'll take your calls, 244-1777, and we take your emails, too, but we'll do that on the other side. You're listening to WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back. It's WDEV. It's Vermont Viewpoint. It's Kevin Ellis with Rusty Dewey.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's leave New York.
All right.
It's the 90s. You've got some gigs. You're doing well.
Yeah.
But what happens?
Movie, TV, commercials, in big national commercials in New York. And my father was 50 when I was born, so at that point I'm around 35, 36. He's in good health, but 86, 85. I never moved from Vermont, Stowe, Vermont. I just worked in New York in my mind, heart and mind.
Yeah.
And the last 5 years of my 11 years in New York City, the 90s decade plus one, the last five I came home every weekend, dude. Drove home every weekend.
What kind of car?
People do that all the time. You know what? I had a Volkswagen Golf, and I had a really bad back because of that for a while. But so on the trips up and back, I just would write these things were coming into my head. When I got out of high school, I logged and landscaped, didn't log much, but landscaped more and drove school buses and dump trucks for Dale Percy and Walker Construction. So when in my mid-30s, I listened to Marshall Dodge a lot growing up, Bert and I.
Yeah.
These stories just came out of my head. Again, no goal. I wasn't like, hey, I've been doing acting. I've been in movies and TV and blah, blah, blah. I'm going to write my own thing and I'm going to do my own thing. No. The goal was, this stuff was coming out of me. You got 5.5, 6 hours sitting there. I don't really listen to radio, which is weird, or media much, or DVDs. I don't occupy myself that way. I occupy myself in my mind. And these stories came out, and George Woodard was doing a Groundhog Opry. I said, George, you got a couple of stories. All right. So I did them, and people liked them in Waterbury. I said, wonder if they'd like them in Burlington. City folk. And so I called Jimmy Swift.
Yeah.
First night. I said, I got these stories. He said, I heard about them a little bit. Plus, I'd been in movies and stuff, and it kind of got a buzz around here. Back when a buzz meant something. Back when you could hear the buzz. Now it's like just trampled upon by the next person. And he said, I hear you swear. I said, well, yeah, but I don't use the vulgarity and stuff. He said, well, first night's non-swearing. He said, but we need content. How about if we put a disclaimer out front, you know? I said, yeah, but people brought their kids and everything, and three shows at City Hall, one show at the Fletcher Library, and one show at Patrick Gym. This is early on. And I had to get up 45 minutes for that. I'd only had about 18. So I got up 45 minutes, which is a lifetime in comedy.
Lifetime.
And it worked, man. And I'm like, city people are liking this. Little kids are laughing. Fancy people are laughing. Not so fancy people are laughing. I go to the Patrick Gym. So, man, I'm doing stuff I don't know how to do. I'm not scared. I have no goals other than the material. I loved it. Still do. And then when it hit, from what I learned from Bill Doyle, those fundamental business rules, you can make up, they can be personal ones. They don't have to be the same for everybody. But you find that business fundamentals are mostly the same, whatever business you're doing. What I learned from Bill Doyle, I put those onto my lager shows, and I did a tour, and a lot of people came.
What year is this?
97.
Yeah.
And I said, a lot of people came. I bet they'll come if I keep doing it. And then I kept doing it, and they did come. And
well, I got to tell you, Groundhog Opry, George Woodard,
yeah,
came to the Chelsea Town Hall,
right,
to the little theater there. Changed my life. It was, God, it was funny.
Very brilliantly done.
Just brilliantly done.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I started there, but that's his deal. That's his at Al Bowery. But so, and then I said, I'm still living in New York.
Yeah.
When I started that lager thing, I'd put up my own posters, do everything. And then I said, I wonder if you put this on video. I was going to do a CD. And this, more than one person said, you should do it on video. I wished I'd have done the CD first, because I'd have learned more about my material. Anyway, I hired Steve Murphy at Lake Champlain Productions back in the day. Rented Virgin's Opera House. I think I rented that. Jerry Ann Smart.
Jerry Ann Smart.
Filled it 2 nights, 3 cameras, 2 nights. I got 1,000 of those videos done. And I said to myself, I'm going to sell these 1,000 videos by Christmas. And they were done in August. And by Christmas, I'd sold 12,000 of them. 12,000 of them. Don't forget, 150 independent bookstores in 1998. Vermont Public Television put it on as a pledge twice. Now the whole state's seeing it. Now instead of renting Harwood Union High School, I can call Bennington. What is that, Mount Anthony?
Mount Anthony.
And rent their high school auditorium because they've heard of me. And I've been in the whole point is, it's like any business. You got to get up and get it. The entertainment part of it, people always say, hey, Russ, can I talk to you about how you've done the thing? I say, yeah, you can talk to people. Well, first of all, you got to know how to play the guitar.
Yeah.
They're putting the cart before the whatever. So I, for some reason, had spent 35 years doing all this stuff, seven years old up in Handy's barn on West Hill being a raccoon in Wizard of Oz. Oh, no, Peter Pan. So I kind of had that, and then I knew it. I did market research. What was the market research for my comedy show? People laughing at me in front of me. I knew, and then it's nothing but go for it. And I didn't see hiding a hair of anybody for 20 years.
So, you know, to get you on this show, I had to call the agent, the publicist,
right,
the PR firm, the your lawyer.
Lawyers.
Yeah, you had to go call your lawyers. I mean, it took days to get – it took a month to get you on the phone because all you do is stand on the stage and perform. They wind you up like Elvis, and you just go out there. Everybody else handles all the other stuff, right?
That's right. No. It's like – so I don't
tell
know
us
the,
about that.
I don't know the percentage of it, but like I kind of just – said a minute ago, the on stage, and this is a challenge for a guy like me who isn't biting everything off now as far as shows. The on stage part is probably like, you know, under 5% of this business, if you think about it, you know. And so I thought I'll do all the rest of it. The call in, you know, it was the yellow pages when I was calling up radio stations back then. I'll do all the rest of it, and then it'll be a full-time job for me. If I just did the coming up with funny stuff and presenting the funny stuff, it's not a full-time job. And by the way, then I have to hire other people to promote me. And who in the heck, I don't care what kind of degree you got, you ain't promoting me. Better than I'm promoting me, because Bill Doyle, William Doyle Galleries, I was his assistant. When he knocked on the estate door on Lily Pond Lane in East Hampton, and the three lawyers opened the door, and Mrs. Robertson was there ready to sell her estate, the contents of her home before she moves, and William Doyle showed up, they freaked out. Yeah. You're William Doyle. He was only 47. And the same thing. I stood up my booths at the Addison Fairs, and here's the key. I'm saying, I did this, I did that. How aren't I smart? No, because I love that.
Yeah.
I was driving all over Vermont to every nook and cranny before it was cool to do that. You know what I mean? Because I love – if I can just drive around and put posters up in every little town and go to the high school and talk to the kids and eat soup at that little town, if I can do that for my life's work, holy crap, then heaven doesn't come after I die. This is heaven.
Yeah.
And that is what it was the blessing, because that every move I've made in this business in 26 years was something I love, at the same time being an integral part of the business.
Okay, so
love and business combined.
I got to ask you this question, because for me, one of the geniuses of your show is what you just said. The fact that you love doing it comes through to the audience.
Oh, good.
No matter who it is, old timers, rich people, poor people, kids, whatever, native Vermonters, out of staters. And you work that line between making fun of us.
Humans.
Mm-hmm. It's the logger, but that's a vehicle to make fun of all of us, so that we can all laugh at ourselves. I think you're the expert. I'm not. Yeah. I'm just, that's how I experience it. Yeah. You know, if you're a logger, you're going to laugh at this. You're not going to feel like you're being made fun of because you
for the most part.
For the most part.
Hope, yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in business. There's some people who take offense, man.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of that?
Early on, I think people didn't understand it, and it wouldn't be the people that saw it. It'd be the people that heard from, I saw this guy, he ain't even from Vermont.
Yeah.
And I never said I was from Vermont. Anyway, that's another story. No, you don't get much of that.
Yeah.
Because don't get much of it. And if you do, they're right. If someone's offended, and I never intend to, I teach a class up at PA, I tell the comedy kids the only rule, don't ever go out there trying to hurt anybody, but you will offend people. By the way, one who is offended is choosing to be offended. Yeah. You're not really offending them.
Could spend a whole show on that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We want to take a call from Catherine in Moortown. Sounds like a first-time caller, long-time listener. Catherine, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Now, let me tell you about Rusty DeWeese, how kind he is. I was up at Woodridge Nursing Home, and he came in to entertain, and he went to the room across the hall. Well, the old fella was having lunch, and his daughter was uppity up, and she didn't want him disturbed. Well, the old fella would have loved it. So he came across the hall to our room, and, of course, we loved it, but what I'm getting at is how he's humble as apple pie. Honest, he's just plain one of us, and he is funny, and he shares his talent. I don't know how much of the time he went up there to Woodridge, but I know he was awful good about it.
Thanks,
All right,
Catherine.
That's it from here.
Thanks, Catherine. Yeah, I got into Woodridge. I was aware of it because that's where Dad died. 13 months there, and then that's when I took up guitar. 44 years old, I've started learning chords to play for Dad. And then any elder care or younger care, place calls me, they ain't got to have a dime. They got to be able to work around my schedule. I'll come in and play. And I do that. If I know I'm going to be in Newbury rehearsal with Patrick Ross, I'll bring my guitar, and on the way home, I just pull into Woodridge, pull into all of them, play for the folks. You know, I love it. I'm not trying to gain any. You know, oh, Rusty's humble. Not really, because I'm doing it because I love it. By the way, I think that one Catherine's talking about, I was actually there reserving a room for myself. I just, you know, I need to, you know, like sooner or later. So I got myself a room. It's a good nursing home. I think
Catherine, thanks for the call. So Rusty, you're going out on tour.
Yeah.
Talk to us about it. You're going to do what you usually do. You're going to book small town opera houses and theaters and town halls. Where, you know, let's talk about what you're doing, and then we'll talk about where people can find you.
Well, today I'll go home after I go to Burlington, and I'm working right now with Enosburg Opera. Working, what it means is I contact them and say, can I rent your hall? And they say, yeah, here's the contract. Here's how much. Stowe, I'm talking right to Stowe Town Hall, 23rd and 24th of February, Stowe Town Hall, Cambridge. Enosburg Opera House, Derby Line, I'm going to go down Fairleigh, West Rutland, all those halls, all already I'm lined up to play. But I rent them, and then I call the papers or email the papers and place the ads that run in the little papers around there. Then I do posters, have them printed, and I go down and put them up myself. I go into the haircutting shop. The haircutting people are in there. Oh, you're coming back, Russ? Now it's, you're coming back, Russ?
Yeah.
When I walked in there 27 years ago, it was like, who's this guy? I said, hey, I'm doing a play, and I talked to your kids in school last week, because I would call the schools and say, hey, I've been in movies and everything. You want me to talk about? Oh, yeah, we saw you on this or that. Yeah, you can come in. So I talked to your kids, and would you come to the play? Oh, that's you? Yeah, by the way, do you watch As the World Turns? I've been on that. You have? Oh, and then they came. But I had the product. So that's what I'm going to be doing this winter. And then people look on Instagram and Facebook, and they'll find out where I'm going to be in those town halls. I take the tickets. You don't pay any money to reserve a ticket. You call my phone number. I answer it a lot of times. And you say, hey, this is Kevin. I'm bringing the wife and my daughter, and we'll be up Cambridge. Russ, what do? I just show up.
And I've noticed from your Instagram feed, you're driving a Mack truck to some of these shows. Well, when the weather outdoors, and you were standing on the back of the truck.
Yeah. That was a COVID
thing. That's a COVID thing.
He didn't know what was going to go on, so I said, I got to get my CDL, get me a Mack truck, and go out and do outside stuff. Didn't even know when this COVID started if people were going to be able to sit outside next to each other.
How'd that go?
It's gone great. People love it. I put a little cookie jar at the end of the flatbed, and you come up and take that little cover of the tin, the glass cookie jar off. You put your 20 in there. People love doing it.
Yeah.
And they sit there in their seats. You know what's funny? It's like, and I do them basically August through September and a little bit in October because I think that's when the weather is most steady. I've done 20 of those shows, and only one has it rained. And the people just sat there with umbrellas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've gone really well, and it's fun for me to drive truck. I love driving truck.
Yeah. Do you?
It's also brand-centric. It's also very brand-centric. You know, I'm not going there in my F4.
Or your Tesla.
No, my Tesla. Right.
Yeah. You got a fleet of Teslas out behind the barn.
A couple of Teslas. Elon's texting me right now. Ding! Hey, Russ, do you think I did the right thing? Yeah. Twitter's up and coming, Elon. By the way, you got 10 kids, Elon. Calm the hell down. Jesus. Just his family on Twitter will be enough. You know?
Crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So, okay, you've got winter shows coming up.
Yep.
There's a website that people can go to find the schedule.
TheLogger.com will be when it gets into the end of December. I do company parties, so I've got four nice company parties already. They hire me. Benoit Electric always hires me. And then you just go on Instagram, Facebook, call me, email me, rusty@thelogger.com. Instagram's rusty.deweese. And if you're in a town, you'll see the poster. And if you don't, I'll be back.
There you go.
Couple of years, 2-3.
There you go.
Beats working.
How long are you going to do this?
You don't know. It's that love. It's that. I don't know. 62 in November.
Do you still get calls from New York to come? Or New York and L.A.?
Every once in a while.
Do you have to balance that?
That's another show. But every once in a while. No, I don't have to balance it. Because there was a point when that first video came out, I said, I can't do this up in Vermont the way I'd like to and do the auditions down there the way I'd like to. So I chose. But, yes, I've got calls over there. Pieces of April with Katie Holmes. I was up here for 8 years, and they couldn't find this certain part they were looking for. And the agent called me and said, Peter Hedges wrote this thing. I went down. Boom, I got it. But recently, Jay did a movie. So I do some of that stuff. But That's not my interest. My interest is living life in Vermont. It's always been my interest since I was seven. My parents moved, my sister and I, my mom and dad moved here. I want to drive to Panton on my way to the Virgin's Opera House and pull along the side of the road and look at those flat type fields. Do I need to go to I see Instagram. People say travel, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I look at Instagram. Somebody went to Scotland. There's this big castle. It's called William Wallace Castle.
Yeah.
It's the name of my dad, William Wallace DeWeese. I said, that's cool. And then there's a picture this woman took out of the William Wallace Castle, looking over the fields and the hills and valleys of Scotland. And I looked at that picture and I said, that's Addison County on a bad day.
Yeah.
that girl just saved me 10 grand. I ain't got to go nowhere.
Yeah, that's true.
I love this. Before it was cool to love it, I loved it. And that's what my job is, driving around. And there's a romance to being on the stage, saying stuff you wrote with no makeup, not even. If the gall darn lights go out that I rent, don't matter.
You keep going.
The plumbing's broke, don't matter. If the hurricane comes and blows the walls of the theater down, don't matter, because them Vermonters will hold on them chairs and sit there while I say stuff.
Yeah.
Better than looking at a 100-inch TV, I think. It's energy flowing. It's a different energy. It's health, too. It's healthy for people to hear words and feel words. By the way, it's not me just saying words. They're saying words to me, because I'm at the front desk. When you come in, I'm taking the tickets.
Yeah.
It's communication. It's humanism, and it's a blessing for me.
In a time when a lot of that is gone.
My phone's right in front of me right here, listeners.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I choose if I want to, how much I use it.
It's a tool.
It's not the phone's fault, man.
Right.
It ain't Elon Musk's fault. That's Dean Martin.
I gotta say, on Rusty's screensaver on his phone, a picture of Dean Martin, the original Rat Pack member.
Yeah, those guys did it. And girls. Anyway. Thanks for having me, man.
Hey. We could do a whole nother hour, but I booked another guest, so we got to stop laughing and get serious here for a minute. But everybody out there, you be on the lookout for Rusty DeWeese's shows coming up this winter starting in December.
Yeah.
What a great way to break up the cold weather. Go
Thanks.
To thelogger.com. The schedule will be up there, and you make sure to have a laugh with Rusty when he's taking your ticket at the front door.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, man. Well, we go way back, and we'll go way forward.
Rusty DeWeese, The Logger, shows start in December. You going to the Chelsea Town Hall?
Now that you reminded me? Yeah, I'll nice, give them an email right today.
It's got one of those old painted curtains on the stage, you know?
That's another thing. You just go see old, these little theaters.
Oh my God.
And Vermont's done really well with the orchid communities. They've gotten together and made some dough, and they do the work.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay, that's Rusty DeWeese, everybody. I'm not sure where we go from here, but we'll recover.
Bob Nay!
We will recover after the break. This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis.
Applause.
You're listening to WGEV.
Only fans!
With Rusty DeWeese. Hello again. It's Kevin Ellis. I'm your host on Vermont Viewpoint. We're going to go right to Washington, D.C. to national news correspondent Bob Nay, where we're going to talk about war in Ukraine, elections, and whatever, what else is going on in Washington, D.C. Bob Nay, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Good morning.
Good to talk to you.
You too.
What's going on down there?
Well, there's a lot. In fact, I've been looking at elections for 45 years, and this is the toughest to predict. I think it's the strangest amount of collisions, I'll call it, coming together around the country during the election process. Right now, obviously, there's not a lot going on in the legislative side of D.C. because this is it. You know, we're down to the wire for the midterms. But there's a lot of talk about the economy, and that's what's sort of on the radar screen today, obviously.
Yeah. What about the elections? We've got an election coming up, and you're right. It is it is hard to predict. You've got if form holds true, you would think that the Republicans would take over both the House and the Senate. Seems like a pretty sure bet they're going to take over the House, but the Senate, because it's got several Trump-endorsed candidates, that the control of the Senate may be up for grabs in, let's see, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, and I'm
Ohio.
Talk about what's going on in the midterms.
Well, you know, during the previous elections, and when I was working for Talk Media News Service, there were 14 of us on staff, and I would make predictions literally 3 weeks out. And I went with early on that Jeb Bush would get out of the primary, Trump would be the nominee. My colleagues laughed. I said, Trump will win the presidency. They laughed. I said, you know, I try to look at not any opinions, but look at what's going to happen. This time, it's different. I think I can maybe call races the day before, maybe. But you've got let's look at the examples, and you're right. The states you mentioned are going to control the Senate or not for whichever party. But let's look at Herschel Walker in Georgia.
Yeah.
Under any other circumstances, and I've been following this election closely, under any other circumstances, Herschel Walker would be absolutely down and out. But it just seems that the party base is willing to turn its head to personal problems he's had with, you know, the whole abortion issue, the children, everything else under the sun. And I think in regular times, that never used to happen. Like, you know, this is unusual. So that race is neck and neck with Warnock and Herschel Walker. Ohio is very interesting. I served with Tim Ryan. I knew he is a great campaigner and appeals to a lot of people in the independent and Republican side. President Trump, former President Trump, got involved and got J.D. Vance, the hillbilly elegy guy, who's a real novice at elections, wasn't in Ohio for quite a long time, got him involved. That race is neck and neck. That could go in either direction. Johnson, Senator Johnson, is going to pull it out in Wisconsin. He's always kind of predicted to lose, and then he pulls the elections out.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania is fascinating. The debate with Fetterman and Oz, of course, Oz is the Republican, Fetterman is the sitting lieutenant governor Democrat, and that debate did not go well for Fetterman, but he probably only dropped about 2.5 points as a result of it. Again, you've got a neck-and-neck race there. Nevada, Laxalt is an old Republican name, but a lot of his family actually came out against him, believe it or not, so that race may not go to his direction. And then Kelly, Senator Kelly in Arizona, I think is going to be in a safe seat. So this is, Kevin, this is, hold on, get your popcorn, and we still got a few days to go.
Well, and Bob, talk to us about, you know, you and I are old enough to remember, you know, we went out and voted, we turned on Walter Cronkite, and we got the results 10 o'clock at night. We're now in an era where two things are going on. Mail-in voting means that you're not going to get the results from a lot of these places until the next day, number one. And number two, a lot of these Republican candidates have said that if they lose, they're going to challenge the results of these elections. I mean, we may be not knowing who's controlling the Congress of the United States for a week or two, right?
Oh, I believe you're correct, and I think that's a – accurate prediction, because there are already, and I don't want to misquote the number,
sure,
but I believe there are already over 100 different types of lawsuits that are in process from people that have already begun to file on different procedures. Can you hand in your ballot? Did you know all of these things in different states? So there's already 100. And I noticed candidates, some of them say, if I lose, it's, you know, we were cheated. You're hearing that out there, you know, too. So I think it's going to be a long process. Now, we do have mandated provisional, the provisional ballots, which I was actually part of with Steny Hoyer, who's the number two Democratic leader, in a bill we did, because that gives you the option to argue that, hey, let me vote, and if you find out my ballot's not proper, then you can shred it. Otherwise, I don't want to be disenfranchised. So that was the theory behind that. But when you do that, it does create, in tight races, it'll create a delay. So the idea was, well, we'd rather have accuracy than, you know, on-day election announcements. So, yes, all of that's going to come together, and I think this one is going to take a while.
Yeah. And you've got Vladimir Putin continuing to pummel Ukraine with artillery. You know, gosh knows what's going to happen in the future there. Control of Congress means that if Republicans control Congress, there's people talking about taking away funding for our support for Ukraine. And then on the other side, you've got those progressive Democrats who wrote that letter and, quote unquote, mistakenly released it. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, this is a – and let me go to the letter for a second.
Sure.
And I served 11 years in Congress. So I look at this story and I think, okay, somebody on staff pushed a button is what happened. And there was basically a letter that was circulated. Some of the people were actually saying they didn't sign it, but it was circulated and by Congresswoman Jay Paul. And they signed it at the time now, back when people thought – you could negotiate with Vladimir Putin possibly and stop this whole Ukrainian, you know, war effort that he was undertaking. Well, the letter never went out, and it was not vetted, as we call it, and to look at it, and is it appropriate? But somebody, I think, on the Congresswoman's staff must have probably looked into the computer and said, oh, something didn't go out and push the button. So the letter went to President Biden, and then Congresswoman Jay Powell came out and said, hey, this is all my fault. Sorry this happened. And so this is kind of going to hurt her, probably within sort of a leader of the progressives. So that happened. So that's a misstep on the Ukraine that they don't want, obviously. On the Republican side, McCarthy, who, if the Republicans take control, would be Speaker, came out and made a statement, I think, in a not so good way, frankly, where it almost looked like, hey, we're going to cut money to the Ukraine. What he's saying in a broader picture is you have a budget and we need to make all considerations in the budget. But it came out as, you know, if he's Speaker, some money's going to be cut to the Ukraine, which had some of the Republicans obviously scrambling. Yeah, both sides did a scramble this week.
Yeah, boy, they sure did. Yeah, and of course they're making those mistakes in a very uncertain environment when you're dealing with a guy like Putin who is now trapped in a corner in a war that he started, and now he's either got to fight his way out or give up and be humiliated. And boy, those are dangerous circumstances, right?
You're right, they are, because he's trying to attempt to seize a city called Bakhmut, which that's the last sort of city remaining in this region of the what they call the Donetsk, and he's trying to basically cut off the energy to the people. Winter's coming, and literally energy is cut off to one-third of the country anyway. Water supplies, food, hospitals, I mean, you name it. You can imagine going through a winter like you have and I have in the eastern part of the United States, going through those winters and not having electric, you know, or water. So he's really taken such a brutal position with the infrastructure also in that country. And people are going to have to decide, people meaning NATO, United States, the whole Western group are going to have to decide how they intend to counter this.
Well, we'll be listening for it all. Bob, we could talk about inflation. We could talk about the Federal Reserve and interest rates. We could talk about the elections till the cows come home. And next time we'll take more time. But I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Kevin.
My pleasure. Bob Ney, national news correspondent in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back. And our guest in this segment is Allison Novak from 7 Days, the go-to place for your print newspaper every week. And they have a great website online. And Allison wrote a really good piece on the Orange County Senate race, which features the longtime incumbent Mark McDonald, the Democrat, against John Klar, the Republican, who's challenging McDonald. And McDonald suffered a mild stroke recently, which reflects what's going on in the Pennsylvania United States Senate race. Mm-hmm. And so, Allison, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this story. I mean, it's difficult to find exciting races when Democrats control the legislature so dramatically. But this Orange County Senate race seems to be something we should be looking at on election night.
Yeah, certainly. So this is one of the races that we thought was, you know, a pretty heated race and that we wanted to cover. And so I had lined up an interview with John Klar and went and met him at Thunder Road. And then the next week we found out that Mark McDonald had a stroke. And so that, of course, put a whole nother, you know, wrench into this race. But as you said, Mark McDonald has been in the legislature for almost 40 years. You know, I spoke with voters in Orange County who, you know, many seem to, you know, like him, feel like he's a good, solid legislator and, you know, was a hard worker. But he is being challenged by John Klar, who 2 years ago ran a very long shot campaign for governor to the right of Governor Scott. And, you know, John Klar is an interesting figure because he writes extensively on websites like True North Reports and American Thinker and, you know, jumps into kind of the culture issue du jour, writes a lot about transgender people as well as kind of equity and anti-racism efforts. He kind of rails against those. And so we thought it was an interesting race to cover.
Well, and I think full disclosure, I've known Mark McDonald for 30 years. I think he showed up to every single Little League when we lived in Orange County. I think he showed up to every one of my children's Little League soccer games and baseball games. So the guy was everywhere. But he is now 79. And yep. I did notice in your article a fascinating piece, which I had forgotten, that district now no longer includes reliably blue Thetford and does include very purple Bradford. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Bradford, as well as I think West Fairley and I think Fairley as well. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, they lost Thetford, which voted 76% for Biden in the last presidential election. And so, you know, that was another reason that we kind of thought this would be a good one to write about. And the Republican Party chair, Paul Dame, you know, said that, like, the redistricting is one of the reasons that the Republican Party thinks this is a winnable seat for them.
Right. I got to ask you the required question of every Republican, which is when you asked Klar whether Joe Biden was the dutifully elected president of the United States, what did he say?
So I actually didn't ask him that question, but he was asked that question at a candidate forum. And he kind of waffled on it. He did not answer in a straightforward manner. So he did mention voter fraud, nationally and also voter fraud in Vermont, though he didn't elaborate on what that was. And he also recommended the recent documentary 2000 Mules, which was directed by a right-wing political commentator, Dinesh D'Souza. It's been debunked. I mean, it claims that there was widespread voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, and it's been, you know, debunked by people, including former Attorney General Bill Barr. And so I think, you know, that was a telling moment because one of the things that I mention or talk about in the article is that Klar is kind of running as a more moderate Republican. You know, he talks about wanting to bring moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats together. He talks about issues like the economy and pensions and agriculture and, you know, those are things that he says he's passionate about. However, you know, at the same time, he's writing these articles that are really inflammatory. I asked him about that, and he, you know, said that he doesn't really think they're inflammatory. He thinks they're provocative. And he kind of blamed also some of it on, well, you know, you don't get published unless you kind of have a certain, you know, certain claim that you're trying to prove. So he kind of he didn't really own the inflammatory label, but he did say provocative.
Yeah. Your last paragraph was really interesting. In a moment of apparent self-reflection later in the day, Clark acknowledged that he could be, quote, a little histrionic. Sometimes he said, that's the only way people listen to you. I thought that was a fascinating way to end your article, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And
thank you. Yeah, I like when I wrote that quote down in my notebook, I kind of circled it because I thought, you know what, this really gets at something. And I did feel like it was kind of a moment of self-reflection, which, you know, it was a little hard to get from him. So,
yeah, interesting. Where does he live? Is he, you said he rents land in Brookfield, and you labeled him with the ultimate I can't find the right word, but you called him a hobby farmer, which in some places of Orange County is the ultimate insult, I would think.
You know, I asked him point blank. I said, are you a hobby farmer? And he said, yes. He said, I'm a hobby farmer. So yeah. He labeled himself that. So I did give him a chance because I had been hearing from people that, you know, he's not a real farmer. And so I wanted to kind of give him a chance to address that. And he did, you know, he did say, I am a hobby farmer. He lives in Brookfield. I think he's been in the area for, I want to say, less than 10 years. And before that, he was in the Northeast Kingdom. He moved to Vermont from Connecticut, I think, in 1999. He was a lawyer in Connecticut, and he contracted Lyme disease and actually had a very severe case of Lyme disease. And that's one of the reasons he says he moved to Vermont. I believe he also has some pretty strong family roots in Vermont. So.
And you also got into the fact that he calls himself something of an addiction counselor. Maybe you could talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So on the initial or the he sent out a couple postcards to voters, but on one of the first ones, one of his like four or five bullet points said Vermont recovery coach. And so I had talked to a voter who said, you know, I don't think he really is a recovery coach, and kind of given me some evidence as to why he believed that. But again, I, you know, reached out to Clark directly and I said, you know, I see that you have Vermont recovery coach on your mailer, and I just want to ask, like, you know, are you a recovery coach? Are you certified? If so, can I talk to someone that you've helped? And he got back to me and basically said, you know, he did, I think, a week-long training. He didn't complete a certification he would have needed to be certified as a recovery coach. And, you know, he said he doesn't serve as a recovery coach to anyone right now. He said he's committed to the issue. And he also kind of played around a little with language and told me that, you know, he never called himself a quote-unquote certified recovery coach in the mailer. So I found that a little bit slippery, but so you know, that's one example of kind of what I heard from voters in that they feel like he kind of misrepresents himself in certain circumstances.
But you attended an event where you say in the article that he was on his best behavior, focusing on making the state more affordable, fixing the pension system, and helping local farms and businesses, including the writing, which I apologize, I have not read, a manifesto on a 14-page farming manifesto in 2020 that calls for giving farmers a temporary tax break to encourage young people to farm, increase food production in the state, and giving a boost to restaurants and tourism. And he's also shopping a book around about regenerative local farming.
Yeah, so, I mean, I met with him several times, and, you know, he was very passionate about his belief that we need to support farmers in the state, that there's a lot of young people who want to farm, and we need to find ways to kind of encourage them and incentivize them to do that. And also there's a lot of people in Vermont that want to buy, you know, local organic food. So it's kind of a win-win for everyone. So he definitely, you know, was passionate about that. I kind of found it funny. I didn't include this in the article, but when we were at Thunder Road, he, you know, offered me like an organic apple from his tree. And it just felt like, you know, he talked a lot about how he believes that, you know, kids are eating crappy food that, you know, has a lot of bad stuff in it. And so I do think that, you know, farming and kind of local farming and regenerative farming is a passion of his, but he certainly gets a lot more attention for the kind of more inflammatory culture war stuff that he writes.
Well, it's going to be fascinating because you've got a longtime incumbent. And look at that. We've got John Clark calling in on the line. And if he's listening, I'm going to say we're going to leave you to the after the break because I want to finish with Allison because we've only got about 60 seconds left. But Allison, thank you for your reporting. We'll take the call from John Clark after the break, and maybe we can get into some of these issues in more depth. You've got a longtime incumbent, Mark McDonald, facing a spirited challenge from a I wouldn't call Clark a newcomer, but he is definitely challenging Mark, longtime incumbent, who has suffered a stroke and is not campaigning. Is that right? 30 seconds.
Right. Yeah, he's not campaigning right now. He's in a rehab facility. He's focused on his recovery. His son says that he's doing really well, both physically and cognitively. But, you know, I did reach out to try to do an interview with him and, you know, respected the family's wishes that, you know, he's just not doing that right now. And so he has a lot of people who are campaigning on his behalf, friends in the legislature that are going out and kind of campaigning for him right now.
Interesting. Allison Novak from 7 Days, I really appreciate you taking the time. Please say hello to our friends at 7 Days, including Paula. You can follow. You can always get your news at 7daysvt.com. You can follow Allison and all the other reporters at 7 Days. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis, your host, and you're listening to WDEV. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to be talking about the week that just happened, the week ahead, because we've got elections coming up. We just spent 15 minutes with Allison Novak from 7 Days, who wrote about the Orange County Senate race featuring incumbent Mark McDonald experiencing a spirited challenge from John Clark, the Republican. And you know what? We have got John Clark on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great, sitting on my hobby farm.
I love, there are certain trigger words in articles by journalists, and that's one of them. Hobby farmer in a place like Randolph, which is dotted with dairy farms, can be a derogatory term, and I wanted to flag that. But you feel free to talk about that, or generally, how's the campaign going?
Well, I think the campaign's going very well, though there are many who want to shift the debate away from what I have pledged to do for Vermonters into things like whether or not I'm a hobby farmer. And to clarify that, we had a farm, we farmed in for 20 years in the kingdom. We had a 160-acre farm, and when we sold it, we had completely constructed an artisanal raw milk cheese house where we milked goats and cows. We also, at the time, had 100 sheep, 40 pigs, and raised chickens and Percheron draft horses. And so I guess now I'm a hobby farmer because I said I'm rebuilding my herd and flock. I have about 14 beef cows and 30 sheep, but at one time I had over 50 Herefords. So I have credentials as a farmer, and it would be wrong to call myself anything other than a hobby farmer now, because I don't really make any money yet, because I'm trying to rebuild my cows. And all my cows had heifers this year, which is just almost unheard of.
Well, fair
enough. I don't have any boys to slaughter, so I have nothing to sell.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would comment in my defense is that Allison, who's, we had a lot of fun together at Thunder Road and otherwise, and I thank her for pointing out that I am passionate about food and improving local food quality and availability and building our economy around it, because we have a huge opportunity with inflation in fertilizers and fossil fuels to support the young people moving here who want to farm, and the other young people moving here with laptops who want to eat local healthy food, not Chinese food or California food. Vermont has a heritage here. But she suggested that I was a little bit slippery about my recovery coach certification, and I should clarify that.
Sure.
I was fully certified as a recovery coach in 2017. They subsequently imposed an additional requirement for certification. I don't even know what it was, because I never could be a paid recovery coach, because I'm not a peer coach. In other words, I have never been a substance abuser who has been addicted for a certain period of time to heroin or other narcotics, and therefore I literally, as I've written about in Vermont Digger, I ironically cannot apply for the job. But I also explained to Allison that and my certification would have expired this year anyway, but I worked as a criminal defense attorney for years. I've worked against drug addiction for 30 or 40 years, and when I ran for governor, I was criticized sharply by the right for supporting the commercial legalization of marijuana. So, you know, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, and so now I'm being painted as an extremist, when in fact I wish voters would look at my issues, which are helping farmers, helping people in recovery, expanding counseling services for people in recovery, especially in prison for inmates, and not putting them all on Suboxone. And, you know, so that's, those are some things I'd like to clarify. And as far as the voting issue, as I've written, Carolyn Partridge, a longtime legislator, seems pretty obviously to have been involved in an active solicitation of voting fraud in a school vote. So my response was that I do believe there are risks of voting fraud, but I specifically said in that debate that I do not believe there are any systemic risks or threats by the government, but that there are those who would try to unethically compromise the vote. And I do want to add that I have run a very civil campaign with Mark McDonald. He's done a remarkable job. He is an indefatigable, hardworking man to keep up with. We have both pushed each other hard, but always been civil and polite. We're discussing the issues.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm very sad, and frankly, it's hurt. The biggest damage to my campaign is when Mark had a stroke, because now there's a sympathy vote. I want to engage on the issues and who's going to serve Vermonters more. And by the way, I'm the young guy, and there have been allegations that I've got all these donations from the fuel industry. VPIRG did a hit on me. That money was received before his stroke, and it's only a small fraction of the almost $35,000, I believe, that I've raised, and my average donations are less than $40, where his are $400, because he gets his money from political action groups and not, you know, NGOs. So I thank you for having me on to clarify those things. I hope people will look at my website, and as you mentioned, a 14-page farming manifesto. Almost sounds socialist, doesn't it? But it's about helping our economy and helping all Vermonters.
Yeah, and it's in this world of unrestrained campaign contributions. I mean, I look at your list of major contributions are predictable. I mean, it's you know, Bruce Listman, Lenore Broughton, Brian Doobie, Skip Valley, Jim Douglas. I mean, those, you know, if you're not going to get contributions from those people, I mean, every Republican gets contributions from them, and that's to be expected. Let me play the devil's advocate role a little bit and ask you, point blank, is Joe Biden the duly elected president of the United States?
As I said, I surely hope so. And after I watched that documentary that I mentioned by Dinesh D'Souza, which I'm an attorney, so I would ask voters to watch it and judge it rather than judge it by those who dismiss it because they don't want them to watch it. A majority of Democrats who have watched it recommend other people do so. I was dismissing any claims of voter irregularities until I watched that movie, and it was very disturbing.
You mean Dinesh D'Souza, a convicted felon?
Well, I have no idea as to his credentials, but what I'm pointing out, Kevin, is that people watch it for themselves. There's actual video footage of people committing voter fraud and stuffing ballot boxes.
Well, a simple Google search will tell you that Dinesh D'Souza is a convicted felon and is a far right-wing
election denier. So Whit, you just said that you certainly hope that Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States. So are you casting doubt on that?
I'm asking people to judge the evidence aside from Dinesh D'Souza. The people he hired and highlights in the film show actual public footage, which speaks for itself, of people wearing gloves, stuffing ballot box with dozens and dozens of ballots at 2 a.m. in key districts. That evidence can be measured independently of disparaging the past record of Dinesh D'Souza. First time I heard of it, by the way. And I'm not promoting Dinesh D'Souza. I'm promoting the documentary evidence as a lawyer that seems to show some irregularities there. And as I also mentioned at the time, I would support, you know, I don't support ballot harvesting in this state. And
do you have any evidence that ballot harvesting has been going on? Because the Secretary of State, Jim Condo, says that it does not go on.
Well, why wouldn't it be prohibited then? Why did the Democrat legislature move to allow it? I think it's wrong for either side to do. That's all I'm saying. Whether or not it's going on, our laws don't prohibit it. And I think that that's dubious in its own right. And as far as the donations I've had, I'd point out that there sure has been a lot of a lightning rod of support for my campaign when my opponent said, if Vermonters don't want a heating oil tax, to get a blanket, for crying out loud, not to swear. And that is a threat to a lot of Vermonters when I heard yesterday $5.75 a gallon for heating oil.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of the reason why this race is so hot, because a 39-year incumbent who has vowed at both debates that he still plans to pass the clean heat standard next session, along with Jay Hooper and Larry Sackowitz, to implement that tax that failed by one vote to override Governor Scott's veto. And 2 years ago, I ran against Governor Scott. I had 38 people run with me on an issue, a list of moderate conservative policies that even moderate Democrats could agree with. And that's why, you know, I won, even though I lost, because several of those people won, including Samantha Lefebvre. And that's how his veto is not overridden. And I hope to bring more people in there to back him up so we can have a two-party system instead of a one-party progressive domination and more taxes.
Well, you make a good point. I mean, and this is a question I always want to ask of Republicans in a Democratic state like this, which is, let's say you win the seat. I can't remember whether the Senate is now 23-7 or 24-6 or – but so you win and you're the senator from Orange County, you're still in a massive minority. How do you conduct yourself in that kind of a Senate when you win, if and when you win the seat? What's the plan? How do you exert influence? How do you get done what you want to get done?
Well, just as we are here with ideas rather than efforts to discredit people for past actions. I mean, I spent my life as a Democrat and got hammered when I ran for governor because I had voted for Obama twice. And here I am, a walk away, when I think many of the values I embrace are still traditional blue dog Democrat values. And many Democrats are reeling at what happened with the Molly Gray race with Becca Ballant. Probably half of the Democrats, once they meet me, understand that I genuinely want to help them and our economy and the pensions. I've been writing about the pensions for years. So if I bring those ideas in, I'm convinced that many, many more Democrats will vote for me on re-election in 2 years, because they will see that I will prove that I really do care, that I really do have the background. I was a tax attorney for a number of years. I have a background in finance. That's why I've been raising the alarm about the pensions and demanding that they be funded, very conservative positions, you know, that our promises to our retirees be kept, and that we're pitting those recipients in our state pension system against taxpayers to come up with money in a declining economy, while the progressives want to pass more and more laws. I believe it's 6 senators are currently Republican. Do we want to eliminate the Republican Party entirely? So at some point, if you have two voices at the table, you might have somebody in the room when Mark McDonald told Vermonters to get a blanket for you know whose sake, that somebody would have said, well, wait, hang on, we're not actually helping the poor people here, are we? Because there's no other voice in the room, and that's why we have some of the highest tax rates in the country, some of the most expensive public schools and health care costs in the country. And One Care Vermont is, I'm reading an article on it soon, is costing us tens of millions of dollars a year, while patient mortality rates increase, our hospitals are deteriorating, and patient care is declining. That's bureaucracy eclipsing Vermonters' best interest, and I hope as a conservative to make it 10 or 15 Republicans in 2024 in the Senate.
We got to take a break. John Clark, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. This is Vermont Viewpoint. It's your host is Kevin Ellis, and you're listening to WDEV. We're back. And it's Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis. Boy, we started with Rusty DeWeese, and then we went to Bob Ney, and then we went to Allison Novak of 7 Days, where we talked about the Orange County Senate race, and then we got the Republican candidate, John Clark, calling in, which is a fascinating, he's a fast talker, so it's hard to break in. But here's a guy who moved from Connecticut, criminal defense lawyer, voted for Obama twice, farmed in the Northeast Kingdom, moved to Brookfield, and is challenging longtime Democratic incumbent Mark McDonald for that Senate seat in Orange County, in a district that has been redesigned to remove the blue town of Thetford and insert the, I would say, purple town of Bradford. And that makes the Orange County Senate seat a seat that Republicans are thirsting for. I thought that Clark's by the way, we'll take your calls, 244-1777, or your email, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'd love to take your questions, 244-1777. We love to talk about both sides on this show, all sides on this show, and I found Clark fascinating. Pretty tough to go from voting for Obama twice and then coming to Vermont from Connecticut, and now you're a watcher of Dinesh D'Souza films, which to me are basically conspiracy theory films, and along the lines of Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter, and others. And Clark, when I raised this issue, he claimed not to know this, which surprised me because he is a well-informed guy. D'Souza was charged in 2014 with making $20,000 in illegal campaign contributions to a New York Senate campaign. He claimed he was being singled out. He pleaded guilty to a felony count of making illegal contributions in the names of others. And so he was sentenced to 5 years probation, 8 months in a halfway house, and a $30,000 fine. Clark on one side is peddling, in my view, conspiracy theory films and refusing to acknowledge that Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States, while on the other hand, talking about small farms, regenerative agriculture. So that's a fascinating sort of approach to the race, and I don't know. It'll be fascinating to see whether it is successful or not. Pick up a copy of 7 Days this week and read Allison Novak's story, and let's go to the phones and talk about this a little bit. We've got Brian from Eden, who is on the line. I hope you call in to talk about John Clark. Brian, go ahead.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, hi. Yeah, I don't want to – you're being very diplomatic and even-handed about – you're being very kind, actually. Saying he's a quick talker, I don't know the guy, and he's probably a wonderful person, whatever, but just some of the stuff he said, he did talk very quickly, which I should do now because we're at the end of the show. To say there's this important documentary everyone should watch, yet the credentials of the person who made it don't matter, and that's some kind of smear campaign, or that he's unaware of it, is just disingenuous. I don't know exactly how to say it. But
well, it's Brian, thank you for the call. Well, it's a classic. It's the classic technique which I'm not going to say that former President Trump pioneered that technique, but he is certainly the expert at saying, well, I don't know what that you should watch this film. I don't know much about the guy who made the film, but people are out there asking questions about it. So you throw this chum in the water and you watch the sharks gather and swarm, and you kind of try to create a chaos in the political system. That's clearly what he's doing. And it'll just be fascinating to me to see whether that message can be successful. Brian, thanks for calling. And look who we've got, Jim Dandenow from the Vermont Democratic Party. You are on the line.
Kevin, how are you?
Good. Welcome.
It's good to be here. I'm calling in because I wanted to just I agree with the last caller. You're being incredibly generous to Dinesh D'Souza, who has been convicted of fraud and is actually currently under investigation by the Republican Attorney General of Arizona for outright falsehoods in that 2000 Mules film. So this film is entirely fictitious, and anybody who's promoting it is either a right-wing conspiracist who lives deep in the fever swamps, or is a grifter trying to put one over on their followers. And I think we can apply one of those to John Clark.
So, Jim, we've got a couple of minutes here. So mm-hmm. I'm looking at a House of Representatives map in across the country that is looking really bleak for Democrats.
Sure.
You have an Orange County Senate race with an incumbent, Mark McDonald, of 30 plus years in public mm-hmm. service, who's just had a stroke.
Yes.
How do you defend that seat?
That seat? We defend it with Mark's record. Mark is an enormously popular and very well-liked person. He's got personal connections with a ton of people in the district. He's been representing it with honor and decency, as he said, for a long time. And we expect him to be back at full speed in January. You know, he's currently undergoing some extremely rigorous physical therapy so that he can be back up and running. But I think folks in the district should be hearing a radio ad he recorded in the next couple of days. You know, he's had plenty of visits. And you know, we're going to rely on his record of decency and service to pull him across the finish line. You know, Mark's a really strong advocate for regular folks. He is passionate to the point of, I guess, irritating some state house insiders when he advocates for his community.
Heck, he irritates me when he comes to all my kids' Little League baseball games for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But, you know, like that's what makes him an effective public servant, yeah. Right? Like he is tenacious. He is passionate. And he keeps his first principles in mind, and his first principles are taking care of the people who need the most help. And that's why he's beloved in the caucus. That's why he's widely respected by his constituents. And we think that's going to carry him over.
I find the strategy of a guy like Clark coming here to Vermont, running against Phil Scott from the right, having voted for Obama. Now he's moved to Orange County and taking on Mark McDonald, and he will not answer the question about whether Biden is the duly elected president of the United States. He said,
I hope so. By advocating for 2,000 mules, he has answered that question. He does not believe that Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States.
Yeah.
He subscribes to lies and conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. And he should not be trusted to represent his district with decency or integrity.
Well, there you go. It's a topic for serious people. These are serious times. This is a serious election, and we're going to get everybody on this show that we possibly can to talk about these issues. So, Jim, thanks for calling in.
Happy to be here.
You're listening to WDEV, and in the time we have left, I just want to tell you that on the next show, we're gonna talk about youth sports, and one of our guests is going to be Linda Flanagan, the host of Take Back the Game: How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids Sports and Why It Matters. I've got a lot to say about that, but I'll try to let her do all the talking. And you can find me right here. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram, and you can always find me right here at Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis, and you're listening to WDEV.